WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
When Kate Simon was growing up, in the years after the First World War, her world was her neighborhood in the Bronx, where most of the adults were immigrants like her parents. The movies gave her dreams of another world of glamour and adventure. She later was given a pass to see the world when she became a travel writer. Simon wrote books about New York, Mexico, Italy, Paris, and London. The distance she had traveled was more than geographical. Simon was the first person in her family to graduate from high school. When she got older, Simon thought back to her childhood and began writing a series of memoirs. Two of those books have already been published, Bronx Primitive and A Wider World. She's working on a third. Her new book is a history of the Renaissance. It covers the art, magic, science, plagues, and sexual practices of that time. It's titled A Renaissance Tapestry. I spoke with Kate Simon from the NPR Bureau in New York. I asked her if writing about travel got her interested in writing about history.
Oh, always. Each travel book was something like a graduate course, and each book was the diploma, the degree. That is, of the travel books. When I, for instance, lived in Paris, I learned a great deal about French history because it interested me and because it gave solidity and quality to the book I was writing, I hoped, and gave considerable meaning to the personalities that were mentioned in various places and streets and so on. And when I lived in Italy, of course, I had to know a great deal of Italian history, particularly since, for one thing, in Rome, I lived practically in the Forum, and there's no point in being in empty ruins unless you knew who inhabited them before they were ruins, and so on and so forth, so that each travel book had a great deal of history. And besides the fact that I felt I should know it, I wanted to.
Your new book is about the Gonzaga dynasty of Mantua. Why did you want to focus on them for this book?
Well, that came through another interest, and that was art. I discovered a great deal of art I didn't know with each book. And in the course of writing Italy, The Places in Between, which is a book that covers many, many small cities, I came across Mantua. Not the most beautiful, not the most attractive city, but the centered around an immense, a vast looted palace in which I found some murals that had not been ruined yet. And one mural showed a family, vibrant, alive, not flatteringly painted, doing things. They were almost speaking to me. A painting of the Gonzaga done by Mantegna, the middle of the 15th century. And I looked at this, and as I said, they were speaking to me. And so I went to the archives, I went to the library, I went to other libraries. It was a good excuse for going back to Italy all the time, and learned what I could about them. And then I became interested in the period and the people of the periods in which they functioned, the artists, the architects, the thinkers, the writers, the guests, the people to whom they were patrons. And that's what makes the book a Renaissance tapestry rather than just straight biography of the family, of the dynasty.
One of the things that interests me about this period is that it's the period when the plague ravaged Europe. And you actually write about different cults that developed around the plague, cults of celibacy, cults of excess, of sexual excess. Could you describe a couple of these?
Yes, they were not exactly cults, although you might call them that, but they were ways of making some philosophic peace with the fact that you were shortly to die. Now, Boccaccio's Decameron shows one level of cure or escape. That is, stories told in a very beautiful setting in the country with lots of dancing and lots of sexing. And then in other periods of plague, when we talk about plague, we talk about almost a continuous series, starting with the Great Plague of 1342. But at some later time in Italy, it was decided that homosexuality was okay. The church okayed it because that was a pleasure, that was a denial of death. Then there were groups that made it almost a rule that sex and love of all kinds and general amorousness and even pornography, which was, by the way, a rather conspicuous part of the Renaissance, were helpful, at least. So I can't say it was cults, but it was modes of thinking in order to escape the plague or escape the meaning of the plague. And then there were all kinds of cures, which were pagan rather than Christian. Drinking your own urine was supposed to have been a way of curing the plague or making an ointment of it. And at one point, apples became very expensive because smelling apples was considered a very good thing, or standing in front of a tannery and taking in the odors that came from the hides. There were all sorts of acts purely of desperation. And then there were political acts. For instance, when a city, a major city and a busy one like Venice, for instance, lost half to two-thirds of its people, it dropped its laws and imported Germans and gave them citizenship, which would not have happened had it not been for the plague.
Now, you're writing about a very wealthy family, the Gonzaga dynasty. How did the wealthy try to escape from the plague?
Well, they didn't always. They did have a good number of country houses in which they hid. But hide as you might, the plague very often got you. Some of them did escape the plague, of course, but one very important statesman among the Gonzaga, in his country estate, well surrounded by people he trusted, etc., who he thought was disease-free, did die of the plague. No one was absolutely safe.
You know, you've described Mantua as one of the places in between, that being not one of the showcase places, and not Venice or Rome, but a place that's really worth stopping at, and it will probably be a place you stop at between the major places. you have a book called Italy, the Places in Between, which is one of your travel books.
Right.
And I want to talk with you a little bit about some of the travel writing that you've done.
Mm-hmm.
In that book, The Places in Between, you write that the informed visitor will not allow himself to be cowed by the deluge of art. And you suggest that someone sees what interests and attracts them. And you say that there is not an Italian secret service that reports on whether you have seen everything, and that if you try to see it all, you may come to resist it all. And I think that you're addressing there a very common problem that the traveler has, which is you're here, you might not be here again, and you want to see everything, but you can't.
Well, I think the sentences you read say it, but it is very, very hard on a short-term visitor. That is, the visitor who has, let's say, 5 days for Tuscany. He has to see everything in Siena, which has wonderful, wonderful painting. He has to see Florence, which is not a very attractive city as city, but a conglomerate of incredible museums. He has to see what there is of Piero della Francesca. And all of this makes him very nervous, very restless, very dissatisfied. He should go slowly, pick out from a picture book maybe that which he must see in reality, and let it go at that.
During the years that you were traveling regularly and writing travel books, did you frequently travel alone?
Very often.
Were there things that you had to be aware of as a woman traveling alone through Europe and Mexico?
Well, in my time in Italy and France, there was no difficulty about walking alone at night, going to a restaurant alone at night, being alone at any time, actually. Mexico was never easy. There were in Mexico City areas where one could go alone, which were areas that were heavily inhabited by tourists from various countries. But the Mexican man decides very often that a tourist lady is out for a little pleasure, which he's very eager to give her. And it can be from embarrassing to frightening. Now I understand, I haven't tried it in Rome recently, you cannot walk the streets of Rome alone as I used to after a concert, after the opera, at 11, 12 o'clock at night. It cannot be done anymore.
Did you develop standard ways of responding to men who assumed that your being alone was a sign that you were interested in them?
Did I develop ways of showing that I was interested in
them? No, that you were not interested. Oh. That their presumptions were wrong and that they should just, like, leave you alone.
Oh, yes. I learned very quickly in each language some very tough thing to say.
Such as?
As, well, in Italian, say vattene, which is like go to hell, you know. Or you go into a shop and sit down for a long, long, long cup of coffee, which diminishes the patience of the pursuer. Sometimes I just laughed. Italian men are very valiant about flirting until they're 180 years old. And to turn around and laugh at an old, a courageous and optimistic but very funny old man discourages him quite well, quite thoroughly.
You know, I think some people are so used to company that they really have to learn how to enjoy themselves when they're on their own. Did you have to learn how to do that, or did that come naturally to you?
Well, it came almost naturally because I was not alone. That sounds rather odd. When you are living in a city and studying it, and going to the markets and going to the shops and watching the people on the street and observing the styles and learning the language, you are constantly in company.
Mm-hmm.
I never felt alone. I missed people, of course. And I used to come back for a month of friends in America. But I rarely, rarely felt alone. I was interested in what I was doing, and it meant something, and it was full of people and sounds and smells and sights which were with me.
When you started writing about travel, did you have an idea of what you wanted to do different from the way travel books had been written?
Yes. Travel books that I knew, with a very few and very good exceptions, like D.H. Lawrence, who wasn't considered a travel writer but was a great travel writer, most of them were just guidebooks, you know, listings. My New York book, for instance, is one of the first that was not like a telephone directory. And I was perfectly willing, rather eager, to be prejudiced and to express prejudice. This I do not like, that I like very much. Criticize, enhance, allure, seduce, demolish, anything you like, but they were personal books, as opposed to many others, and many others being done now, which are very good as practical guides, but mine are not what you would call practical guides. They try to explore people. They try to explore art, history. I'm an amateur sociologist. I'm an amateur architect. I'm an amateur city planner, and that all goes into the book.
I want to talk with you more about your travel writing and about your life, but first we're going to take a short break. My guest is Kate Simon. She's a travel writer who also wrote two acclaimed memoirs. Her new book is about the Renaissance. It's called A Renaissance Tapestry, The Gonzaga of Mantua. We'll talk more after this short break. This is Fresh Air. Travel writer, historian, and memoirist Kate Simon is my guest. You know, you've described so many places in the world so well. A few years ago, you turned to describing your own life in a series of memoirs that you're still working on. Can I ask you to describe the neighborhood that you grew up in?
Yes. It was in the Bronx, then called the North Bronx, because it was north of Tremont Avenue. The Bronx is now, as you know, all South Bronx. No one makes distinctions. But this was a neighborhood north of Crotona Park, and Crotona Park was our summer camp, our Eden, our exploring grounds, our fresh air, our trees, our flowers places. And it was a mixed neighborhood, extraordinarily interesting and very valuable in later learnings for me. About one side of the street, of our particular street, was Italian, Southern Italian uptown, downtown, Northern Italian uptown. Across the street from those small houses were tenements, which were inhabited by Jews, Germans, Romanians, Hungarians, Polish people. We even had a Chinese laundryman. We had no black people at all that I can remember. And the paste that held all these people together was the needs and the fears of immigrants. They came to each other when they were afraid of people who spoke perfect English. That was them. That was like the enemy, the school nurse, the truant officer, the rather frightening policeman, people from immigration. So that we did have a sense, no matter where we came from and what our language was, of interdependence. My mother, for instance, took care of little Italian babies in convulsions. The Italians who fought with each other, the Southern against the Northern, and that, by the way, is where I learned some very colorful Italian, used to come to the Jewish families rather than to each other.
Now, I'll bet that you knew very few women who were professionals outside of your teachers. It's always interesting to me when someone grows up in an environment where few women work and then becomes a working person themselves.
Well, my mother had been a working woman. My mother, on 1 year of schooling, managed, by the way, to learn 3 or 4 languages reasonably well. But she had been apprenticed in a corset shop when she was 8 and learned all the skills she needed to open a shop when she was quite young. And it was a very successful shop in Warsaw. So she was a career woman in that sense and always wanted to go back to the career that she knew and did. When we were in school, she used to go from house to house selling services or courses, I don't quite remember, and ultimately went back to having her own shop with employees. But she was the only one, other than teachers and librarians, both of whom I adored and who were a rare and wonderful race. I knew no other professional women.
Well, even when it was time for you to go to high school, your father insisted that you go to a commercial high school so that you can learn secretarial skills, figuring that that was the only job you'd ever be able to get.
That's right. The best you could do was file clerk, typing, maybe bookkeeping or shorthand. But those are rather high in that series of steps.
When you were coming of age, you write about this very colorfully in one of your memoirs, in your memoir, A Wider World. You really wanted a much more exciting life than the one you saw in your neighborhood, a more cosmopolitan life. And you started dressing in a very rebellious kind of way and behaving in a very rebellious kind of way. When you look back on that now, do you think of that as affectation? Are you embarrassed by any of that? Are you proud of it? Do you think of it as a necessary transition, something you had to go through to proclaim your independence?
I think that I was expressing what adolescents do now. They express it in much more dangerous ways very often. But I had to leave parental controls, I had to expand my horizons, and I had to try on various roles. The costume has become rather famous among my readers, the long coat and the borsalino hat and the black sneakers. But that was a role I tried on, and that suited me for a while. And then in college, later on, still in adolescence, I suppose, I tried on emotional and mental roles of being the wife of William Morris, for instance, or traveling with some great poet or great painter and being his helpmeet. And all of these are adolescent fantasies which have to be, in a way, tried on and discarded when one is ready to discard them. And one never really, really discards them. They're always lovely fantasies that one can look at with a smile, with a little bit of pleasure, not seriously, but a nice thing to own.
I really like the way you put that, because I think a lot of people look back on their teenage years and are slightly embarrassed about some of the roles that they tried on.
No, no, I'm not embarrassed. It was a great time, and
I
cherish
that.
It.
You know, one thing that really amazes me about your adolescence, as you were coming of age, you were very sexually free. I mean, you had your own inhibitions and everything, but you weren't going to let society's standards define what your behavior was going to be. And consequently, when you were a teenager, you got pregnant a couple of times, had a couple of abortions. It was incredibly dangerous to have abortions. And, I mean, truly, you could have been killed by them. I think a lot of women in your position would have chosen to have the baby not because they wanted to be a mother, but just because the risks, I mean, not necessarily because they wanted to be a mother, but because the risks of abortion were so great. I guess you were really firm on not wanting to be a parent at that age.
No, I knew that ultimately I would want to be a parent, but not then.
No, I meant not at that particular
then.
Age. Yeah.
I wasn't ready, very much not ready. And something, I think this is true of many adolescents, I was testing my courage. Many, many adolescents are a little afraid of what they are afraid of how afraid they must be or might be. And I kept pushing and meeting challenges in many ways, and one of them was the abortion. And also, it was not uncommon for girls to have abortions with illegal abortionists, some of whom maltreated them, some of them didn't. It was not one of those very rare experiences. We think of it as rare now that abortion is legal, but it was not. And then we had heard terrible stories from our mothers, our aunts, of self-aborting, of using dreadful instruments on themselves, or drinking what I would think of as poisonous or semi-poisonous medicines to induce abortion, so that when we went to something that acted like a doctor, we had difficulty with the money, but not so much with the fear of real danger.
You said you always knew you wanted to become a parent. Did you end up having children? I really don't know this about you.
Yes, I had a daughter who died.
Oh, Mary.
Ultimately.
I'm sorry.
Well, I'm sorry too, but it's all right.
You are continuing your series of memoirs now.
Yeah.
And at this point, you're writing about being a young adult. This is a book that hasn't been published yet.
No, it's in the writing.
Is this a harder period to write about? I think perhaps adulthood isn't as crystallized for us when we look back as childhood and adolescence is.
No, it isn't as crystallized, which is a good word. And also, when you write of your childhood and your adolescence, this is far away. The problems were not enormous. They seemed overwhelming at some points, at some times. Then, but really, they were experiences in bizarre acts with bizarre people, learning judgments, trying to learn who you were, how much breath you could put into your life. Later on, you meet the realities of love, whatever that is, of mating, whatever that is, of relationships which are firm and meant to be firm and sometimes are very infirm. You meet disease, you meet death, you meet the death of friends, you meet the death of relatives. You are in another world, actually, from that rather bright, carefree world of childhood and adolescence, although it doesn't seem carefree at the moment. When you look back, it was carefree compared to adult experiences.
What are you doing to bring back memories, to give those blurry memories the detail with which you write about them?
Well, I write for a first draft very straight, as if it were a distant story. And then I go back and fill in details which may give me the heightened emotion, not give me, but give the words the heightened emotion they should have. I fill in, I delete. In other words, I purify in order to make what I hope will be both true and effective.
Well, I look forward to reading your new volume, and I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
Travel writer and memoirist Kate Simon, her new book is about the Renaissance. It's titled A Renaissance Tapestry, The Gonzaga of Mantua. It's published by Harper & Row. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.